I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Read Like a Writer is the books podcast from Faber & Faber, Serpent's Tale and Canongate, three independent publishers bringing the voices and the book recommendations of their authors to your ears. It's hosted by me, Anna Fielding, and in each episode you'll hear about the books closest to these authors' hearts, their latest projects, and learn a bit about their favourite independent bookshop too. This week, it's another one that we're hosting from Edinburgh, highly appropriately, as we'll come to see. And we're here now with Ambrose Parry, or rather the two people who make up Ambrose Parry, which is Christopher Bookmyer and Marissa Heitzman, who in addition to writing together are also husband and wife. Christopher has published books of crime fiction, largely set in Scotland, with the occasional diversion to outer space. He's won numerous awards, including the Scottish Crime Book of the Year for 2016's Black Widow. And spanning across different formats, his book Bedlam was also turned into a video game, which Chris also wrote the script for. Marissa is a consultant anaesthetist and has worked in the field for over 20 years. And it was her research for her master's degree in the history of medicine that inspired the plot of their new co-written novel, The Way of All Flesh. So welcome both, and thank you for battling the very heavy festival traffic over from Glasgow. This is the city that your book is set in, but I wondered if you could tell me a bit more about the novel in general.
Well, as you say, the novel is set here in Edinburgh in 1847, and it follows the exploits of a young medical student, Will Raven, who has just started his apprenticeship with the very renowned professor of midwifery, James Young Simpson. And he teams up with Sarah Fisher, Simpson's housemaid, as they investigate a number of suspicious deaths in the city.
Sarah is, she's working as a housemaid, but she's a very capable, very intelligent, quite brilliant young woman, but also really very frustrated by the limitations that are placed upon her as a woman and as a working class woman at the time, that the limitations upon her by in terms of how much she can educate herself, and even if she could educate herself, there wouldn't be much of a career to be had anyway. So it's a household where the two of them are very quickly at odds, because she's quite jealous of the opportunities afforded to Raven, but Raven's quite a tortured soul anyway. But they come together in the household of James Young Simpson, who was a remarkable individual, but also he had a very remarkable household. Very atypical. It was not the Victorian household as we assume it to be from other works of fiction.
Yes, because James Simpson is a real figure. As you say, Marissa, is a huge part of medical history. And this depiction of his household is pretty realistic as well, isn't it?
It is. It's based on a lot of information gleaned from the multiple biographies written about the man. He had a household that included his own family, visiting relatives. He was often had visiting dignitaries to the city, staying with him. He also saw patients from his own house. So there was clinics running in the morning, and there were multiple descriptions of patients spilling out of the waiting room into the hallway, onto the stairs, which was remarked upon repeatedly as being quite an unusual thing.
Also the kids running around all the time. There wasn't this notion of them being seen and not heard. You know, they were all over the place by all accounts. And encouraged to run about wild with the dog as well.
So various pets that his wife didn't really approve of.
Even a parrot. And we just kind of, that was one of the things that warmed us to, or made us warm to Simpson, this very, a notion of someone who's very much a family man, you know, that he would hurry home in between cases to spend some time with the kids. And he wanted that time with the kids to be as sort of rambunctious as possible. So this sort of thing made us think, well, this is not the portrait you normally get of some brilliant scientific or medical figure.
Yeah, you get this idea, this sensation from reading your book of this really rather charming domestic chaos. complete with, you know, sarcastic butler.
And we thought he would be someone who would be an inspiration to someone like Will Raven, who's a, you know, he's someone who's in need of inspiration at that point. He's lacking a good male role model, shall we say. And Sarah, for all her frustration, she is, comes to realise she's in a much better situation in terms of the house she's working in than she might find herself in Victorian Edinburgh.
You've mentioned Sarah's sense of frustration a couple of times now, and what I thought was really strong throughout was there's a real strong sense of the historical restrictions or the unjustness on women of all classes, from the prostitutes working in the old part of town to the housemaids to, you know, the unmarried sister of Mrs. Simpson. There's this sense of continual frustration and being stopped up or forced into extreme measures all the way through.
Yeah, I think that was certainly something that came across very strongly while I was reading the background material for the book. And I think reading some of the background material, it was all too easy just to think that women accepted the role that had been given to them. And when I started writing about Sarah, I think I was perhaps slightly concerned. I was thinking about her with too much of a 21st century head. But then I started reading about Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Shelley and the Vindication of the Rights of Women, which was the end of the 18th century. So I think the frustration felt by a lot of women was certainly not something that I dreamt up.
I think it was always there, but just wasn't documented because the histories of, well, the social histories were often written by men and who wouldn't have even been aware. That was part of the problem. We weren't even aware of how frustrated women were, because for one thing, someone like Sarah, an individual such as her, would not be in a position to voice her frustration for fear of it leading to harsh consequences.
Which would be dismissal from her position. Yeah. And then without any references, she wouldn't really have any legal ways of making a living anymore.
Dismissed without character is, I believe, the phrase that Marissa uncovered.
It's used in the book as well, which I actually thought was I'm glad you brought that up. I thought it was a wonderful turn of phrase. Mm. It's almost like this stripping away of the self, isn't it? Not just Now, it's interesting as well, the other thing that I thought skewed towards a... it's obviously, you know, a crime novel and a detective novel in some ways, but what is being investigated, the deaths of these young women, I don't want to give too much away, but obviously several of the central characters work in the field of midwifery. Mm-hmm. There's talk of kind of illegal abortionists and people trying to rid themselves of unwanted children in various different ways. And that's kind of how the plot forms and is taken by. How did you come across that? Was that part of your research, Marissa?
I think certainly the antagonist in the book was based on a real-life character from slightly later in the 19th century who was a doctor who, for reasons best known to himself, he was an abortionist, but he, for reasons best known to himself, liked to poison prostitutes. And was eventually tried and convicted for it. And he had a very particular way of poisoning them. And I think that was probably the start of it. I think I was interested as well as exploring the problems for women at the time in terms of reproductive rights and the difficulty that they faced. The interesting thing I found about our antagonist was we were trying to represent the two sides of medicine, the humanitarian side, which we sometimes assume is always there, and then the opposite of that were people who are in it for their own personal aggrandizement or for various other less than humanitarian reasons. And we thought the antagonist represented that quite well.
Moving on slightly, I mean, you also use the city as much of a character. There's one point where it's described as having two faces, like Janus, you know, the proprietorial, forward-facing, everything is respectable side, and then the disreputable, using prostitutes and dark deeds side. And it's also bisected with the old town and the new town and the contrast between those. Was that a deliberate use of the two parts of the city?
Oh, quite definitely. I think from the beginning, one of the things that attracted us to Simpson as an individual was that he transcended two sides of the city. He was sought after by the aristocracy as a medical practitioner, but he would minister to the poor and off in the old town and often not ask for payment. And I think he was very consciously aware of the divides in Edinburgh at the time, and we wanted that to be tangible, you know, physically, and that Raven has spent his student years in the old town near the university, and he aspires towards this more genteel and privileged locus of the new town, which where literally when he crosses the bridge, everything is better. He in his mind, even the people even walk a little straighter, and we wanted to reflect that. And it's a recurring story of Edinburgh, is of the two sides of Edinburgh, because you preceding that you get the story of Deacon Brodie, which was part of the inspiration for Jekyll and Hyde. You know, very well-to-do religious figure who by night was up to all sorts of nefarious activities and was ultimately hanged for it. And it actually, just to bring it back to Simpson, as everything always does, Robert Louis Stevenson was a close friend of one of Simpson's sons.
I think the other thing that interested me was the idea of the kind of financial split, the poor of the old town, the rich of the new town. And what I loved about Simpson was he really didn't care about money very much. He being quite humble stock himself, I think he was very, he very much enjoyed his time spent with upper class patients. I think he got a lot out of that, but he didn't really care about the money. There's this great story about how he stopped a rattling window with a £10 note that was found later, and how his Jarvis the butler had to go through his pockets at the end of the day to kind of collect all the money just stuffed in there. And his wife often complained that he was wont to spend his time with the poor and forget to collect the fees from the patients who had any money. And it was one of those things that, again, you don't know how much of this is strictly true or whether some of it's apocryphal, but I just loved the character of the man who loved what he did and didn't really care about the financial implications quite so much.
It's quite interesting because a few of those stories are ones that have made it into the book as well. And I was wondering how you went about that blend of fact and fiction. Do you feel a responsibility to the...
Marissa really does.
Yes, I definitely did. In fact, it was a very interesting process in trying to deal with the massive amount of historical material that there is on Simpson and trying to turn it into a novel. It was quite a tricky proposition. And I was finding it quite difficult to kind of fictionalise a lot of things. And as Chris had to keep reminding me that it is fiction, you are allowed to kind of make up the bits that you don't know. And but I was very strict about not veering too far away from the actual historical facts.
How did that work for you, Chris, being someone who's always dealt in fiction?
Well, one of the great privileges of it was that I'd always liked the idea of writing a historical novel, but I've been quite prolific and I didn't feel I had the luxury of time that would be necessary to spend the time that would be appropriate and necessary to research a historical novel. So it was quite a luxury to have someone do it for me, but not just do the research on my behalf, but to bring to it a perspective that's entirely informed by having been an anaesthetist. Because I think there was things that Marissa focused upon in what she chose to focus upon in her research, and also, more importantly, what elements of that research she chose to concentrate upon for fiction and for the drama. She saw drama in things that I think many researchers wouldn't have realised the significance of, because of I think just the small dramas of all of these obstetric cases, these obstetric procedures, that I think having worked as an anaesthetist and having worked in medicine for 20 years, she understood what would be going through the doctor's mind during those procedures. I think anyone else writing it might have just described what went on, but wouldn't have known what the stakes were or what the what sort of emotions were going through the heart of an apprentice or indeed an experienced doctor. So it meant that I wasn't presented with some huge body of work and then asked to write a story. I was... we got to the stage where Marissa had accumulated all this and started to sketch out characters and sketch out the story, and got fed up waiting for me to finish my preceding novel, and just kind of started to write the book herself. And eventually I sort of caught up a little and wrestled with it myself for a while, and then we would sit down and between us work out where we thought the story ought to go.
Although I think we did have to be quite disciplined. As I said, there was so much material, but in the end, there were the little stories, the historical stories had to fit in with the plot, not the other way around. And I think that's when we realised that's what we were doing. That's when we really started to make progress with it. Mm. So any story that's in there had to justify its place, in order to fit in with the plot and the themes.
It couldn't just be there because we liked it. I mean, that was we did kind of argue about that a wee bit. You know, there was certain instances it had, if a story served a purpose in terms of driving the plot or telling you something about the characters, it could stay in, but there was no anecdotes just shoehorned in there.
Although it was tempting.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I actually finished it off on my first night in Edinburgh, so it was snuggled in bed with the pelting down rain outside, and I thought it was brilliant.
Thank you.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
We're going to talk about the books that inspired you in the writing process as well. The first one that you mentioned is This Thing of Darkness by Harry Thompson. It was his debut novel, written just a couple of years before he sadly died at the very young age of 45.
Yeah.
But it's also a novel that's also set in the mid-1800s, as is yours, and it also involves real people, this time on the HMS Beagle. Could you tell us a bit about kind of what that novel means to you in the context of writing this one?
Yeah, I think it was a really remarkable book. I thought it took real historical characters and events and fictionalised them in such an intriguing and entertaining way. And although Charles Darwin was obviously part of the Beagle expedition, the book really was about Robert Fitzroy, who was captain of the Beagle. And it was just the most enlightening thing that I had read in such a long time. And when I looked into what was true and what was not true about the book, there was so much of it was based on historical fact. I just thought it was a completely remarkable achievement.
And to take something as big and as well known as Darwin on the Beagle, you know, everyone would just assume, they'd think Darwin on the Beagle goes to the Galapagos Islands, you know, and that's the kind of greatest hits of the story. But really, the heart of the story was Fitzroy's battle with his own soul, you know, Fitzroy's struggle with his religious beliefs, because and Darwin's struggle in realizing that the evidence that he was starting to uncover was undermining his religious beliefs, and he was more open to that. And Fitzroy, however, really does he really does go through this crisis of faith because of it, and ultimately kind of recoils to some extent. I mean,
I think in the end he felt guilty about facilitating the scientific discoveries that were made. Mm. Because it was in such conflict with his own beliefs.
Yeah, and it also, though, that you got such an amazing sense of being there. I think this was something that inspired us, because a lot of historical fiction sometimes reads as if the characters themselves know they're in history. You know,
yes,
it's like the kind
so.
Of, well, we better hurry up because the Second World War is going to start in 6 weeks, you know. And whereas it was a story where there was a real sense of its own modernity at the time. The fact that there was these amazing scenes of ships being caught in tropical storms, and how that led to Fitzroy ultimately devising the shipping forecast, you know, the means of predicting weather and sharing the information with other mariners in the future. So it was just one of those books. All the way through it, you just every page you turned, there just seemed to be some new, not just new adventure, but new perspective on a story you thought you'd heard told before.
It's interesting you say that, actually, because looking at your second choice, which is also sort of set in the 19th century, it's The Alienist by Caleb Carr. And when I was thinking about it, I was thinking, there's a certain thing about science in that period and the way people write about kind of Victorian intellectual life. And you know, recently we've seen it in Sarah Perry with The Essex Serpent and A.S. Byatt's Possession. But this really wonderful Victorian sense of like, hey, let's just throw it all at the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah.
This incredible kind of rush towards knowledge that was happening at the time. And some of it got dismissed and some of it became orthodoxy. And The Alienist as well is very much part of that. I was also thrilled I learned something, and I didn't realise an alienist was also a term for a psychiatrist at the time.
Yes. I think the idea being that people who were suffering from mental illness were alienated from their own true natures, which is why they were called alienists. And what I loved about the book was its exploration of the scientific developments of the time. And basically the main character, the alienist himself, is basically undertaking psychological profiling in order to uncover a serial killer. And the detectives who are working with him are using very early scientific methods, such as early fingerprinting. And what I loved about the book was the confidence to take several pages to explain exactly what they were doing, so that you understood the science of the time. And I thought that was really just wonderful.
One of the things that sticks with me about The Alienist, though, was its depiction of New York at the time, of how the city really becomes a character. It was something we were, I think, both inspired by when we first read it. We read it about 20-odd years before we tried to write our novel. But it depicted that era in a way that was so unflinching, but also depicted the ways in which society did flinch from it. That part of the problem in addressing some of the crimes, specifically child prostitution, was that society did not want to acknowledge that this even happened. So the newspapers couldn't write about it. Politicians couldn't discuss it. The police were dealing with it, but they had to almost like pretend they weren't. And that element of it was so shocking, because it showed you how the most powerful people were kind of blanching at the very notion of what was a truly horrific problem, but their own sensibilities meant they were so disgusted with it that they'd rather it was going on and nobody told them than actually deal with it. I suppose that's like any good crime novel. It's when something forces that to the surface. And I think that, to me, was one of the most compelling things about it. It was genuinely shocking.
because the murder is focusing on kind of young, very young male prostitutes who are also from immigrant backgrounds and kind of the kind of people that really wouldn't get any attention from the establishment at all. And you have the sort of central character, the doctor, who kind of assembles his own crew of outsiders in a way to get it done.
Yes. Yeah. Because of the police corruption at the time and all these vested interests and not dealing with the problem properly, he did have to kind of form his own kind of squad of investigators. And the detectives who helped him were both Jewish. So they were held in a great deal of suspicion by other police officers. And he had a whole collection of people he had saved from the street. So there was a young boy who worked with him who had been saved. And he had a whole house full of children, I remember, who he had saved from the streets, and various other, all his household staff he had saved in some way. It was really a very interesting combination of characters.
That great sense in a crime novel of a crew of outsiders, yeah, who've all got individual talents that we might be otherwise overlooked by the establishment, but together they can be threaded by an individual who's quite brilliant in order to solve a crime that otherwise would have gone unreported, never mind unsolved.
Is a really brilliant trope, isn't it? It crops up again and again from, like, you know, the X-Men to The Wire. I was also going to say, you mentioned very briefly, you said, oh, when we read it years ago, do you often read the same books at a similar time?
Only if something really grabs one of us and we're sufficiently able to persuade the other of its merit.
I think we started to kind of deviate a wee bit in the last few years. I've always been a huge fan of historical fiction, and I don't know that you really have, Chris. I think we do have kind of differing tastes. So it is special books that we both read, I think. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad The Alienist was one of the ones that was special enough to make it across the boundaries. Now, on to, well, I think if we were Desert Island Discs, this would have counted very much as terrible rule-breaking, because you've actually snuck several books in under the guise of one. And Chris, down by your feet, there's quite a hefty library of the three books that comprise Neal Stephenson's The Baroque Cycle. Mm. Can you tell me a bit about why you love them so much?
To me, The Baroque Cycle is the single greatest achievement in 21st century fiction. I actually have to preface it by talking about the books for which it all forms as a prequel, because it was a book called Cryptonomicon that Neal Stephenson published in about 2001, which is kind of about the Second World War cryptography and code breaking and code making. And it says that somehow he seemed to be inspired to go back and write the history of the ancestors of the characters who appeared in Cryptonomicon, but also writing the history of, I suppose, the kind of ancestry of computing. He was inspired by finding out about the likes of Leibniz and scientists and thinkers of the time who did start to think about problems and think about science in a way that was that anticipated, I suppose, computer technology. And he fills, like all of his work, he fills it with very kind of geeky in jokes. So there's a character called Root who appears in Cryptonomicon, and everyone else's ancestors appear in the Baroque Cycle, but Enoch Root becomes apparent in Quicksilver. It's the same person, and it's because Quicksilver is partly about scientific inquiry that strays into alchemy, and he is someone who may actually have found some sort of alchemical property to keep himself young. But what I loved about it was that it blended historical figures and historical discovery. So a crucial character in it is Sir Isaac Newton. Hook is in there, and there's the reconstruction of London after the fire, and you just felt every time you read a chapter you learn something else, but not just in a way that's, it's not like some guided tour. It's all pertinent to character and to plot. So it what drives it most is that it is a swashbuckling adventure. It starts with the time of the Restoration and the beginnings of the Royal Society, or what became the Royal Society. And in that respect, it is a history of modern thinking, because it gives you the history of modern banking, modern philosophy, modern science. Even it gives you such a wealth about etymology as well. For instance, where the word banking comes from, you know, that it was to do with a Spanish word for a bench, wasn't it? They would set up a bench. And so you feel like you're immersed in it. And actually, it goes on for these three colossal volumes. But by the end of it, you kind of wish he would just keep writing the rest of history, because he brings it to life like no other work I've ever read.
It's interesting using the phrase "bring it to life," because I'm someone who's always, you know, learned a lot from fiction. I think a lot of the facts I pick up about the world have come from reading novels. Mm. I think sometimes novels can be undervalued as a way of learning about the world, not just about emotions, but about solid, concrete facts.
I think if you're engaging with it more, it's like in the same way as museums evolved from being just collections of exhibits to try and find ways to engage particularly children, but everyone to interact and to see what's being presented in a way that they can relate to, a way they can see as being alive rather than just some object that seems distant and is behind a glass case. And I think that's what the most exciting historical fiction does. It gives you the sense that you're there, or at least what it would have been like to be there.
So we're moving on to your next two choices, which I'm going to keep as a pair because they're both by Kate Atkinson. So we have Life After Life and A God in Ruins, published 2 years apart and both concerning the same family. So we start with Life After Life. It's a very literal title, actually, isn't it?
Yes, yes. It's about, I think the idea from what I read about Kate Atkinson's thoughts on the novel was the idea of what would happen if you had the chance to keep reliving your life over and over again. And it's about Ursula Todd, it's so beautifully done. It's because this is something obviously that many authors and writers have looked at, but it's so beautiful because it all starts with, you know, on a winter's night in 1910, a baby is born, draws a breath, and then dies. And then the next page is the same thing again, except the baby doesn't die. And then this happens. She dies at different stages in her life all through the book until she finally gets to the end. And it's just the most remarkable piece of writing. But it deals very much with living through the Second World War and the Blitz in London. And I just thought the sense of time and place was so remarkable in how it was written. There was a small episode where Ursula goes back to her little flat, and it's very cold, and she turns on a little gas heater, and just the way that the whole thing is described, you could just see it. I just thought it was an incredible novel. A really interesting way to explore such an important time in history.
And it's actually it's not just a trope, but strangely, I think it's a trope that's emerged from more modern technology. It's video game logic. Is of the being able to keep reloading and live a life over and over again. It was explored in the Tom Cruise movie, Edge of Tomorrow, and to some extent Groundhog Day as well. This idea, I think Nietzsche posited it, that if we could keep reliving our lives over again, we'd eventually get it right.
I think that's a brilliant way of putting it, that it's video game logic. and I guess as well, God in Ruins, we have a different kind of video game, because this concerns Ursula's brother, Teddy, who is a bomber pilot during a very similar period.
Yeah, it was, again, if I had to choose between the two, I think I preferred A God in Ruins, just because Teddy was such a heartwarming character. He was such a lovable guy. And it was his experience. I mean, there's only a relatively small amount of the book is to do with his experience as a bomber pilot during the war, and the rest of the book is about the rest of his life, his childhood, and what happened after the war. And again, it's just the most remarkable thing. You become so involved in everything that happens to him. And again, the descriptions of the bombing of Germany during the Second World War it's so emotive, even though it only forms a relatively small part of the book.
And then, of course, we go on, and it's his relationship with his daughter as well, isn't it? And then your final choice is Any Human Heart by William Boyd.
This is definitely a favourite of both of us, isn't it?
Yeah, we converge again here.
Yeah, yes.
Which has that brilliant, brilliant quote from Henry James on the opening page, which is, "Never say you know the last word about any human heart," which I love. As they're all, it sounds very warm, but essentially the fact that we're all unknowable as well.
Yes, and there's a bit early on in the book where they talk about the fact that every life is both ordinary and extraordinary, which I really like too.
You're talking there about the character in Gregorian Ruins, finding his wife has died. It was one of many times during Any Human Heart where I found myself blubbing away, because Logan Mountstuart he's such a compelling character because he is not a hero. He is not always sympathetic. He keeps messing up. You know, that's what I liked about it, was it showed the way in which he was shaped by his experiences, and other ways in which his personality attempted to shape the world around him, often with adverse consequences. And it is a history of the 20th century.
Absolutely.
That's what was so striking about it.
And I love the Logan Mountstuart, of course, is a completely fictional character, and the book is told through his journals of his life, but he keeps bumping into real people. He had a friendship with Ernest Hemingway, and he was recruited during the war by Ian Fleming to become a naval intelligence officer. And it's
the
all
Bahamas,
these...
wasn't it?
Yes,
Caribbean.
Yes, it was all these little interactions that for some reason you just find completely thrilling when a fictional character interacts with a real person.
I think it's when a fictional character interacts with a historical figure, and it's done in a way that's convincing.
Yes.
That's really exhilarating.
Yes.
I think that was quite inspiring to us, the idea that you could include genuinely significant historical figures, but you kind of had to earn the right to include them. You know, you had to know your stuff, and you had to make it seem plausible that your character's interaction with them would be believable to the reader.
Yeah.
But Any Human Heart was just one of those books that it was so emotional from first page to last.
Let's discuss your favourite bookshop, which you told me a bit about already, and it sounds fabulous, and I think you always come away from there with several bits of swag of your own as well.
Definitely. It's quite unfortunate we don't have a independent bookshop close to where we live, but anytime we're up north, anywhere in the region of Aberfeldy, we go to the Watermill Bookshop, which is in a converted watermill, and it's just the most beautifully converted building. And it really is like an oasis of peace and calm. They have a wonderful selection of books. I very rarely leave without buying several. And it's just, they've just done the most remarkable job with the place.
I think the selection there is very interesting. There isn't a massive amount of space, and yet the selection always seems to be intriguing. You know, it's the kind of place where you just find yourself in one corner of the shop for 10, 15 minutes and then another corner of the shop for another period of time, and you just find things. I picked up Michio Kaku's The Future of the Mind, it was called, and it was just full of, you're just browsing it in the shop. I could, reading the first few pages, I feel my head already start to spin, so this is totally for me, and it fed into my novel Places in the Darkness, because it was very much about the implications of how technology might change neuroscience in the future. And that's what I love about it. You go into a bookshop and you pick up a book you didn't know existed, and all of a sudden you've got an idea for a novel.
Yeah, it's that ability to browse that really makes it, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, soon you will be on the shelves as Ambrose Perry, and hopefully many people will, one, deliberately buy, and secondly, browse as well. Thank you both very much for joining me. It's been great to have you here. I shall leave you to enjoy the rest of the book festival, what remains. Read Like a Writer was brought to you by Faber & Faber, Serpent's Tale and Canongate Books, and was presented by me, Anna Fielding. The Way of All Flesh by Ambrose Parry is out now. And to get a full list of what this week's authors recommended, visit readlikeawriter.co.uk. And we'd really love to hear what you think, so do tweet us at readlikeapod.
Even even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.